Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, December 10th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, local environmental groups urge HCOG to recognize the climate crisis in new regional transportation plan. Four-year payment plan approved for Measure S tax debts. And the National Weather Service in Eureka issues a sneaker wave warning for Thursday, December 11th. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
The Coalition for Responsible Transportation, or CRTP, the Environmental Protection Information Center, or EPIC, and 350 Humboldt are working together to push the Humboldt County Association of Government, or HCOG, to acknowledge the climate crisis in its regional transportation plan. The Regional Transportation Plan is the official long-range plan for transportation in Humboldt County. It is updated every 4 years, and the new draft was just released for public comment. KMUD talked with Colin Fisk, the executive director for CRTP. He explained that HCOG is made up of representatives in the county of Humboldt and all seven incorporated cities within the county. Looking at the transportation plan 4 years ago, the change this year is astounding when looking at it from an environmental perspective.
One thing that we think is really important is that, if folks aren't aware, almost three-quarters of our local climate pollution comes from transportation. So from a climate perspective, this regional transportation plan is really important. And in the last version, about 4 years ago, HCOG added a bunch of very specific targets for reducing climate pollution from transportation, including, you know, installing electric vehicle infrastructure and going forward with more walkable housing development and better bike and pedestrian infrastructure, more transit service, those kinds of things. And also, you know, explicitly acknowledging the climate crisis. And unfortunately, for this current version, the draft that's been released really walks back some of that progress that was made last time.
According to the joint press release from CRTP, EPIC, and 350 Humboldt, quote, the new draft plan, however, eliminates every use of the phrase climate crisis from the document. It even goes so far as to audit the phrase climate crisis out of a quote from the California State Transportation Agency, one of many state agencies that routinely refer to climate change as a crisis, end quote. Fisk said that HCOG was unable to follow through with a lot of their environmental promises 4 years ago, but that does not mean they should just give up.
They did not meet many of the targets. Some of them they did. And I think part of the argument is, well, we didn't, you know, we weren't able to meet all these targets, so we have to delay them. But really, you know, climate change has only gotten more severe in the last 4 years, and addressing it, it's well within our abilities, but it is going to require us to do things we haven't done in the past. We can't just go on with business as usual. And so we think that, you know, sort of just undermining the urgency of the action by delaying targets and, you know, removing language that identifies climate as a crisis is really backing down from the moment. And I think it's particularly troubling because this is a time when the federal government is also, you know, scrubbing language about climate change from all of its documents and really undermining climate action. So the need for local governments to step up is greater than ever.
Fisk believes this plan's disregard of climate change now will negatively impact future environmental plans.
Well, I think that it undermines the urgency of taking climate action, and it sort of sets us up for making it more difficult to do so in the future. So one example is that there is a target in the current regional transportation plan that 80% of new housing should be in areas that aren't car dependent. So areas where people can walk or bike or take the bus to important destinations within a reasonable period of time. That still leaves 20%, you know, of new housing that could be built in more rural areas, but it really represents a shift for us in terms of creating the low-carbon development. And unfortunately, one of the proposals is to delay this target, which is currently a policy already in effect, to delay it all the way out to 2030. And, you know, what that means is we could be building more car-dependent, more high-carbon development in the next 5 years that will be very difficult to mitigate afterwards. And so, you know, sort of digging the hole deeper by delaying these policies is not going to help.
Another part of the plan that the groups are questioning is HCOG's approach to Vision Zero, a movement the region committed to that tries to improve road safety.
The idea is that crashes, and particularly serious crashes that kill or seriously injure people, are preventable, and we are working to completely eliminate deaths and serious injuries on our roads. And, you know, we know how to do it. There's lots of strategies that work. And so, HCOG, in its existing plan, has that Vision Zero goal and has a lot of other more specific targets for improving safety. And I would say that I don't want to get too wonky here, but, you know, one objection that we have to the current plan is that it measures safety progress by the number of crashes per mile instead of just the total number of crashes. And if we're trying to completely eliminate, deaths and serious injuries, then it doesn't matter what the rate of crashes is. It just matters how many there are. And so, you know, that's sort of a change in the way of thinking about it from the old way of thinking about crashes, which is that they were just inevitable and there's nothing we could do about them. But HCOG has acknowledged that we can prevent these things, and we should be working to do that. And, you know, we applaud them for committing to that. We just need to make some changes to really organize the plan around prioritizing safety.
The regional transportation plan will be open to public comment through December 29th. Comments can be sent to info@hcaog.net, and the website hcaog.net has more information about this plan. Fisk added that CRTPS has an email list where they send updates about this and other transportation issues, which can be found on their website, transportationpriorities.org. KMUD reached out to the Humboldt County Association of Government for comment, but was unable to get an interview before today's broadcast. Recognizing the struggle of Humboldt County's cannabis industry, payment of Measure S cannabis tax debts has gotten a significant extension, Daniel Mintz reports.
Having repealed the Measure S cannabis excise tax, Humboldt County's Board of Supervisors has now extended the deadline for paying back tax debts. The deadline for paying overdue Measure S taxes was the end of this month. But at the December 9th board meeting, supervisors came up with a new plan for paying the debts. Starting in 2026, cannabis farmers will pay 25% of what they owe each year of a four-year period. Planning Director John Ford told supervisors that if the deadline that supervisors had set is followed, his department would suspend the permits of those who still owe taxes with large batches of permit revocations in February. He said at this point, 518 permit holders would be subject to suspension and revocation, a little more than half of the total number of permitted cultivators. But Ford suggested there's an opening for doing something else.
I just want to say that I know the board has received emails. I've talked to people. I mean, every number up there represents a person. Some of them have stories that it's hard for me not to be sympathetic to. I'll just say that. I know this is a hard decision. And that's why I wanted to bring it back and make sure this is really the direction the board wanted to go. I mean, I know that some people are waiting to sell their product right now. And we know we've talked about it enough that late fall is not a good time to sell because the price is at its lowest. If they can hold on to their product, sell late winter, early spring, that's typically the best price to be able to sell for. And so some people who are willing to pay their taxes would like the opportunity to pay them, but need that amount of time.
Supervisors were hesitant to follow through on the deadline they'd set, and the four-year tax debt payment scenario was on the floor for public comment. Cultivators who spoke supported it, including Indy Riggs of the Stafford-based Galactic Farms, who said giving farmers leeway supports the struggling industry.
Many of us have felt for a long time that this partnership with the county has been, you know, one of being regulated and taxed for many to the point of going out of business, as we all have heard and seen. So it's nice to see the support this continued support coming from our partner, the County of Humboldt. And I would just like to iterate that with emerging markets and economic sectors, especially in rural areas such as ours, you cannot tax and regulate an economic sector into prosperity, but you can support that sector to the point that it does become prosperous. And then maybe there could be some money from that. So I would like that to be understood. That's just economics 101. Let's work together, all of us, to continue to build a sustainable and resilient cannabis sector in our county and in our communities, that there is a future for that.
Ross Gordon of the Humboldt Growers Alliance said extending the deadline will ultimately yield the results supervisors seek.
I do think this idea of 25% over 4 years makes sense. Once we're at a point where it seems like it's administratively possible to require payment over time, I don't see why it should matter to the county whether that happens over 1 year or over 4 years. Doing it over a longer period of time is going to provide more people with an opportunity to pay, an opportunity to bring that revenue in. I think we'll bring more revenue into the county and we'll put you in the position of having to create these punitive actions that I think nobody really wants to take for people who are showing good faith by virtue of paying annually. So I would encourage giving people a longer timeline to pay as long as they are meeting a certain minimum amount annually. And I think the 4-year timeline sounds like it's one that a lot of people would be open to.
Most supervisors supported the 4-year, 25% a year plan. Revocations are still in the mix, however, as permit holders who haven't entered into a payment agreement plan with the county by the end of the month deadline will be subject to suspension and revocation. With Measure S repealed, the debts are all that remains to be paid. Supervisors voted 4-1 to approve the deadline extension, with Supervisor Steve Madrone voting against. He had said that a shorter time frame of 2.5 years is reasonable. In Eureka for KBUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Today, the National Weather Service in Eureka issued a warning of a generally moderate swell that will generate a moderate risk of sneaker waves along the entire coast of Northwest California on Thursday, December 11th. The warning will stay in effect from 10 a.m. Thursday till 7 p.m. Thursday. KMA talked with Zaira Velez, a meteorologist for the National Weather Service, Eureka.
It will cover the entire Northwest beaches. That would be from Point San George, Cape Mendocino, and Cape Mendocino till Point Arena. All the beaches along the Northwest coast will see this race of sneaker waves on the beaches.
She explained this warning comes from a storm located near Alaska.
It's a mid-period westerly swell that is generated by a storm currently located near Alaska. So this swell, it will be arriving. Seems like right now our seas are really low due to the lighter winds. So these waves will be coming like clean and can run up into shoreline.
She also issued a warning for beachgoers who might encounter a sneaker wave.
So that is important that never turn your back to the ocean and avoid steep beaches, jetties, outcroppings, and rocks during this event. That is the most important thing. For those beachgoers, encountering sneaker waves can be knocked down and dragged into the ocean. That's why people need to be aware of those sneaker waves. So they are the sneaker waves, just in case people doesn't know, they are potentially deadly waves that unexpectedly surge much farther up the beach than previous waves. So the sea or the ocean could be like calm, but just one wave can be like fool you. So it's important, don't let the ocean fool you with a unexpectedly wave, because that can overtake beachgoers.
For more updates on sneaker waves or weather forecasts, visit the Eureka National Weather Service website at weather.gov/EKA/. Turning to Mendocino, public comment on the once-in-a-decade update to the management plan for Jackson Demonstration State Forest is due at the end of the week. Elise Cox reports on what's new in the plan and why local residents say it's not enough.
Every decade, CAL FIRE updates the management plan for Jackson Demonstration State Forest. And every decade, the tension between timber harvesting, forest health, and community well-being surfaces anew. This time, two new priorities are shaping the plan: improving relationships with local tribes and supporting state climate mitigation goals. At a meeting in Casper in October, State Forest Programs Manager Kevin Conway laid out some of the changes driving this year's update.
There's also been some significant public policy changes that have given us some additional tools for managing our natural and wildlands. So some of the significant items I'd like to draw your attention to that we've attempted to incorporate into the draft plan, and we look forward to your comments on how well we've done that and how we might do that better. Our first, tribal co-management.
Conway walked the audience through more than a decade of state-level actions, from Governor Brown's 2011 order on tribal consultation to the Truth and Healing Council formed under Governor Newsom to the Native American Ancestral Lands Policy passed in 2020.
This directed state landowners such as CAL FIRE and JDSF here to provide access and co-management opportunities to local tribes. And in 2022, CAL FIRE, recognizing all of this, had our Jackson Advisory Group really do a deep dive into the policies in our existing management plan to review it and provide recommendations on how we can better incorporate those into our existing activities.
He said JDSF has begun incorporating those recommendations and that tribal input is now embedded in everything, from land acknowledgments to historical materials to project design.
We feel very privileged with the amount of time that local tribal leaders have devoted to working with JDSF staff on co-creating projects with the specific goal of providing tribal benefits and advising us on our activities on the forest.
Conway also highlighted the forest's role in climate strategy, from carbon storage and beneficial fire to biodiversity and wildfire resilience.
And I think there's recognition that redwood forests can play a leading role in climate change mitigation in the forest sector. Beneficial fire, we've been challenged to reintroduce beneficial fire into all of our forests in many ways, both prescribed fire, cultural burning, pile burning, really, you know, any way that we are able to, because we've starved our forest to fire for the last 100 years.
But many in the community aren't convinced the draft plan goes far enough or gets specific enough. Scientist Evan Mills says more detail is needed.
We've read the plan in full. We see considerable potential, really, to improve the draft plan's rigor and its clarity so that it can be effectively used by you and by the public as a management tool. As is, the document has little, if any, context as to which environmental practices from the 2016 plan or the 2018 plan, as you described, have actually been retained or modified or eliminated in the current plan. You talked about state context, which is good, but what has changed would just be very helpful in the document.
Resident Ellen Beekner argues the plan leans on an outdated model, justifying continued commercial timber harvesting with research programs.
We don't have time for that mindset anymore, and everyone who walks in the forest can feel it and knows it.
The public comment period closes December 12th. CAL FIRE expects to release a revised draft in March. For KMUD News and MendoLocal.News, I'm Elise Cox.
In state news, low-income Angelenos get $363 million in medical debt relief. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
Christmas is coming early this year for some families in L.A. County, as letters arrived this week letting people know their medical debt has been forgiven. Some $363 million in medical debt, owned by 171,000 people, has been permanently erased since the county's medical debt relief program began last year. Allison Sesso is president of the nonprofit Undo Medical Debt, which is administering the program for the county.
There's no action an individual can take to buy this debt on their own, and there's nothing anybody has to do to get this relief. They just have to receive a letter and know that that debt has been relieved and they're free and clear of it.
She says this current round of debt relief will eliminate $180 million of debt held by 39,000 Los Angeles area residents. To qualify, people's income must be at or below 400% of the federal poverty level, or their medical debt must equal 5% or more of their annual income. CESO says her organization, Undo Medical Debt, is using $5 million in seed money from the County Department of Public Health to buy people's debt.
We buy medical debt similar to a for-profit debt buyer. Medical debt can be bought for pennies on the dollar, so we're able to take $1 and alleviate as much as $100, if not more, of medical debt. And so that's why we are able to do this amazing debt relief.
Undo Medical Debt has more than 25 partnerships with state and local governments across the country. CESO adds the nonprofit is also working with two other groups in California to raise money to reduce medical debt. One is run by the Global Shapers Los Angeles Hub, and another is sponsored by students at California State University, San Marcos. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, Supreme Court hears GOP challenge to campaign spending limits as midterm congressional elections approach. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
The Supreme Court heard arguments Tuesday in a case that could upend political campaign spending laws less than a year ahead of the upcoming midterm congressional elections. At issue is limits on how much political parties can spend in coordination with candidates for Congress and president. The limits stem from a desire to prevent large donors from skirting caps on individual contributions to a candidate by directing unlimited sums to the party, with the understanding that the money will be spent on behalf of the candidate. But a Republican-led drive, backed by the Trump administration, seeks to overturn a quarter-century-old decision and erase those limits. The case was filed in 2022 by Vice President J.D. Vance, who was then a candidate for the Senate. Conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh sounded sympathetic to the arguments.
The combination of campaign finance laws and this court's decisions over the years have together reduced the power of political parties as compared to outside groups, with negative effects on our constitutional democracies.
The Federal Election Commission and the GOP argue that the court should cast a skeptical eye on the limits, in line with recent high court decisions. But Democrats are calling on the court to uphold the law. Justice Sonia Sotomayor is one of the court's more liberal justices. She said, every time we interfere with the congressional design, we make matters worse.
Once we take off this coordinated expenditure limits, then what's left? What's left is nothing. No control whatsoever.
The case is the latest in which the conservative majority could upend congressionally enacted limits on raising and spending money to influence elections. The court's 2010 Citizens United decision opened the door to unlimited independent spending in federal elections. As for Tuesday's hearing, Justices Alito, Kavanaugh, and Thomas all voiced skepticism about the limits, while the three liberal justices signaled they would vote to uphold them. The other three conservative members of the court, Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Amy Coney Barrett and Neil Gorsuch, either said nothing during the arguments or not enough to indicate how they might vote. But the conservative majority has been skeptical of campaign spending limits in the past. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. For people experiencing addiction, it can help to talk to someone who's been through recovery themselves. Peer support specialists offer a different kind of support from therapists or psychiatrists. And in Alaska, there are state certificates for peer support roles, including a special track for Indigenous people with lived experience in recovery. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra has more on peer-to-peer care in the state.
Josh Engel is bundled up on one of the first really cold days in October to do outreach in a homeless encampment in Anchorage. He approaches a man in a weathered coat.
How long have you been out here on the streets?
Too long.
Yeah? You connected with any resources?
Engel is a manager and peer support specialist at True North Recovery in Wasilla. One of his aims today is to help guide people into recovery. It's a path Engel knows well because he's in long-term recovery himself. Now, he supports people in ways that go well beyond what a more traditional therapist or psychiatrist can do. He may text with clients outside business hours, help them find work or get connected with benefits, anything that supports them in a way that might lead to recovery.
I personally really enjoy being able to connect with them on like a personal level of someone that has walked their path.
When patients interact with workers with lived experience, research shows it can aid recovery and can reduce healthcare costs. Erin Surma is executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, in Juneau. And Surma experiences mental illness himself. He says psychiatrists and mental health professionals play an important role in supporting recovery and treatment, but there is a strong power difference.
The dynamic is that you have the expert and the person who needs help.
Surma says he was arrested multiple times during high school and was court-ordered to go to Alcoholics and Narcotics Anonymous meetings. He says hearing peers in those groups was awesome, but things felt different when talking with his formal providers.
When I was a teenager, I was lighting stuff on fire and buying garbage bags of weed. So then to go into a small room and talk to somebody, it's a million miles from what you know.
He says it's easier for peers to bridge those gaps in early recovery. Peer support specialists speak the language of addiction and mental illness and also understand the more traditional language of behavioral health professionals. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Seeds of Eden, which offers addiction recovery services and community-based behavioral health services, recently received a $30,000 grant from the South Dakota Community Foundation. The grant will help the organization with its work to provide sober living, peer support, care coordination, and case management, including a project to build a recovery housing facility on the Standing Rock Reservation on the South Dakota side. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe straddles the South Dakota and North Dakota border. Isaiah Keller is one of the co-founders of Seeds of Eden. He says they've already secured a home, which is being remodeled to offer future services.
The house that we have been remodeling is about 90% complete. A small portion of the funds that were awarded will go to finish that house and to make it livable and to make it functional.
Keller says Seeds of Eden was designed to help fill a gap when it comes to addiction recovery services, and he says the group realized there was a need for assistance within tribal communities. He says they've been working closely with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, Native American board members, and Native advocates.
We've partnered with a really good ally and advocate, and her name's Bobby Jamerson. She has been advocating and promoting recovery and community involvement. We're at a point right now where we feel like we have some great traction and some great movement.
Keller says they'd like to expand services across South Dakota and beyond. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Elise Cox, Suzanne Potter, Christopher Martinez, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.